Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program, New Advances in Bone Health for People Living with Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer-related organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 1,264 people on this call today, so I want you all to take a big bow because you've joined us today, and it's just terrific to have you all on the call, and you come from all of the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Canada, China, Dominican Republic, England, Guatemala, India, Indonesia, Ireland, Mexico, Pakistan, Singapore, and Venezuela. So you truly come from all over the world, and you are actually a global audience. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. Now, in those materials, there is information about our speakers and about the topics that will be covered. And there also is information about all the different organizations that have worked with us to promote this program and all of their resource information, the toll-free numbers and their websites, as additional resources for you in addition to Cancer Care. And we also have an evaluation form in your materials, and I would ask you to please take a moment and complete those evaluation forms. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer in these programs? Now, I also would like to say that the topic today is one that many of you have asked us to do. It's one that clearly is of great interest to all of you, and so we very much take your recommendations to heart and really try to follow through on what you ask us to do. Now, today's activity is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of our program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker is Dr. Joseph Lane. Dr. Lane is professor of orthopedic surgery, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He's chief of metabolic bone disease service, Hospital for Special Surgery. You can see he wears many hats, and he's going to cover screening for bone health and risk factors, prescription medication to promote bone health, and the role of nutrition, exercise, and calcium supplements. Dr. Lane?
Thank you, Caroline, for allowing me to participate in this telephone conference call. We're going to cover a bunch of topics today, and specifically, as an orthopedist, I'm going to give my attention to skeletal health, muscle health, and body health, which is very important in the setting of a person who is trying to either be treated for cancer or prevent themselves from recurrence of cancer. Basically, the skeleton consists of calcium and collagen, and it holds your body together, and inside it is where your bone marrow occurs. And this is a very complex organism that does this action, and it's very important to maintain it in good health, particularly in the setting when you're trying to fight another disease. There are certain elements related to the skeleton. It maintains our posture. But it is vulnerable to breaks if we fall, fractures, and some of these can occur after trauma or they can occur spontaneously, just the load of living in a world where we have gravity. And so good body health and good bone health will protect the skeleton, even in the case of situations where we're put to stress. Now, what are the elements of good bone health? We must maintain the mineral content of the bone. And if we go after the mineral content and we do not have enough calcium in our diet, the body solves that problem by cannibalizing the skeleton. And that will lead to weakness of the bone, and we have various names for that. If it's mild weakness, we call this osteopenia, and if it's marked weakness, we call this osteoporosis. But ultimately, if you take enough mineral away from the skeleton and you then set it in a situation where it undergoes mild injury, such as a fall from standing height, then you can break the bone. And that is our whole goal, is to try to prevent that from basically occurring. So how do we protect the skeleton? The key to protecting the skeleton is adequate nutrition, number one. If you have inadequate calories, the body will seek calories by eating up its own tissue, and the bone is the least important tissue, and that will go first. Secondly, you have to have enough calcium in your diet. Now, one glass of milk is about 250 milligrams of calcium, and we need basically somewhere about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium to maintain your skeleton. So you need about 4 glasses of dairy products a day, or to take a calcium supplementation. And there are various forms. There's calcium carbonate and calcium citrate. The beauty of calcium citrate is that it will dissolve in anything, and it will prevent kidney stones. Calcium carbonate requires you to have an acidic stomach, and if you're taking agents such as Pepsid or agents to try to prevent an acid stomach, the calcium is no longer functional and will not be absorbed. So the bottom line is 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium, preferred in a citrate form. The second element about the mineral is the vitamin D. Vitamin D comes from sunlight on your skin. You generate it. But in the northern environments, this is we're usually short of this. And so you have to get it as an additive in the food. There are very few natural sources of vitamin D in your diet other than cod liver oil and some of the fatty fishes, so that the body basically gets this through pills. Now, the government has set the requirement at 400 RDAs a day, but we now know that they've understated the situation. And more people are taking supplements far beyond that level. And it is not uncommon to take 1,000 to 2,000 units of vitamin D in addition to what is in their multivitamin and in their calcium preparations. It is rare that your calcium will go up with vitamin D, but in the setting of cancer, if there is extensive involvement of the bone, one has to be very careful that the vitamin D is not causing an elevation of the calcium, and it must work with your oncologist in that particular area. The third part is to actually say, where are you starting? Where were you when you got your cancer? And we determine the amount of bone mass by doing an entity known as a DEXA analysis, and that will determine the bone density. And we categorize you as being normal, mildly lost, such as osteopenia and osteoporosis. Using that information, your oncologist and your physicians can then develop a strategy to maintain your skeleton or to add to the skeleton if it's deficient. And we do this with, again, the DEXA machine, but the DEXA only looks at bone mass and doesn't look at the quality of bone. And quality of bone is a difficult issue to analyze, but certainly if you have had a fracture, at a low-energy fracture, a simple fall with a fracture, that tells us there's something wrong with your skeleton. So even with little bone loss, that implies that there are imperfections and that should be basically corrected. There's a way to determine this. It's with a system known as the FRAX, F-R-A-X, and this looks at age, and it looks at body mass, it looks if you're smoking or drinking, whether you have an autoimmune disease, other kind of diseases, and puts together a package which then determines the risk of getting a hip fracture or a more generalized fracture. So those things are used by your physicians in determining your status. And the last tool that they can do is, beside measuring laboratory values such as your vitamin D and your calcium, is the bone turnover. Are you losing bone too quickly? And if you are, we would use an agent which protects your skeleton from losing it. Or if you are, your bone is asleep, we have methods to wake it up. Now, the key to the treatment beside calcium and vitamin D, the keys are good nutrition, exercise, and drugs. Nutrition, I cannot emphasize the importance of this. It's very critical, reasonable, well-balanced nutrition. In terms of exercise, there are two elements. Muscle exercises will stimulate bone to be maintained, but the big problem we have is when people fall, and in that area we'd like to give balanced exercises, and the most effective exercise is Tai Chi. And that's an exercise that anyone could do, and it's a very simple exercise, but it teaches single leg a stance and teaches you not to fall over. In terms of the drugs, the main drugs that we use today are anti-resorptive agents. And these are traditionally either bisphosphonates, or they can be SERMs, which are anti-estrogens, calcitonin, which is a weak agent, and there's a new drug coming along, an anti-rank L drug, which will be coming out as another agent, finally, to prevent you from losing bone. And your oncologist and your physician will pick the drug that's most appropriate and put this in consideration of your cancer state. Now, very large doses of these agents, in fact, will not only maintain the skeleton, but will prevent you from having tumor growth into the bone. So zoledronic acid is an example of these agents which will go in and protect the skeleton, and the new anti-rank drugs, which are about to be released, will do the same activity. So basically, going back over the story, one, recognize the skeleton is critical. Two, cancer has a tendency to go to bones, so you need as strong a bone as possible. Three, drugs used for the treatment of cancer therapy can cause loss of the skeleton, and the skeleton must be protected. And then finally, you can recognize the starting status of your bone by doing a DEXA and appropriate lab studies. And then when you're facing that situation, the treatments are adequate calcium, adequate vitamin D, adequate nutrition, exercises including muscle building, and balanced training such as Tai Chi, and finally the appropriate drug, and your oncologist will help you in that choice to make sure it is most consistent with the treatment goals for your particular cancer. So I want to thank you, and we'll get you back to Caroline, and then she will lead you on to the next speaker. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lane. This is an excellent and very informative presentation. I think we've all learned a lot about just the care of our bones and what we can do in terms of maintaining them during treatment. Our next speaker is Dr. Ronald Blum. Dr. Blum is a medical oncologist. He's professor of medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's director of cancer centers and programs, Beth Israel Medical Center and St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center. As you can see, Dr. Blum also wears many hats. And Dr. Blum is going to address a number of issues. He's going to talk about the overview of cancer and your bones, advances in the treatment of bone loss and bone metastases, clinical trials, controlling pain and discomfort, and doctor-patient communication. I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Blum.
Good afternoon, everybody. It really is a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk to so many people and bring information about bone health. As it relates to cancer treatment and cancer care. Let me start out really by focusing on what I'm going to try and cover in the next 10 minutes that's been allotted to me. So I want to give you an overview of, if you will, cancer and your bones, talk a little bit about the clinical problem of cancer metastases, talk about what the clinical consequences are of bone metastases, that is, when the cancer spreads to the bone, talk about clinical pathways that we as physicians use and that hopefully you will partner in making decisions about diagnostic procedures and treatment procedures. I'm going to focus on really two diseases where bone health and bone metastases are a significant problem, and that's in women, breast cancer, and in men, prostate cancer. And I'm going to finish up talking a little bit about doctor-patient communication and how important it is to partner with your healthcare team to focus on this issue of bone metastases and bone health. So with that introduction, let me begin to talk about cancer. The fact that many cancers, unfortunately, as part of the natural history, do spread to the bone, so-called bone metastases. The most common cause of cancer pain is bone metastases. So this is an important clinical problem. It occurs most often in the following types of cancer. Breast cancer, bone metastases occur. Prostate cancer, I'm going to focus on those a little bit, but I do want to mention other common cancers, lung cancer, kidney cancer, myeloma. These are cancers that, by their natural history, we know more than other kinds of cancers can spread to the bone and give you metastases. The main consequence of that clinically is pain. And let me just focus on that for a moment in terms of the importance of assessing and treating pain related to cancer, in this case specifically to bone metastases. So the most important thing, of course, is to have the opportunity to get asked the question. Pain assessment is one of the vital signs that should occur at every clinical encounter, and this is mandated by a number of overseeing agencies. So how's your pain should be part of how's your blood pressure and how do you feel. We tend to rate pain as, hopefully you know, zero is no pain, 10 is so bad you can't stand it. But we know if we communicate in a quantitative way, we can be much better at assessing and treating pain, and particularly assessing what the results of various treatments are. Now, there are many types of pain, but let me just focus on two types of pain. One is so-called ordinary pain, or nociceptive pain. The example we use is a toothache, but a bone metastasis, when it expands in the bone, puts pressure on the lining of the bone, and that gives you so-called ordinary pain. And that's compared to what we call as neuropathic pain. And the best example of neuropathic pain is when you bump your funny bone. It gives you pins and needles, a sensation, electrical, can be temperature changes, oversensitivity. Generally, for bone metastases, the main type of pain you have is ordinary pain. And this can be treated really quite effectively with painkillers, analgesics. And the important point is to make sure that you get a pain medication that, in fact, relieves your pain. Could be ordinary acetaminophen, Tylenol, aspirin, non-steroidal drugs, but more often for bone metastases, it will require a narcotic, a weaker narcotic like an oxycodone, or a stronger narcotic like morphine or hydromorphine dilaudid. So the right pain medication, the right dose and schedule is the one that makes a person comfortable. Very important. Please remember that also all of these medications cause constipation, so you should be on a stool softener. So once the pain's under control, then what are the next steps? Well, you want to understand what's the mechanical issues that are causing the pain. We want to be very sure in a clinical pathway that you're not, that you don't have a fracture, that the patient doesn't have an impending fracture. So often what we do initially is to do a bone scan or a PET scan to determine the degree of the involvement of the bones with tumor. We'll often do a regular x-ray, a so-called plain x-ray, particularly of weight-bearing bones, which are the legs. The arms actually are considered in this category weight-bearing, and the back. If you have pain in those areas, you want to make sure that you're not at a risk of fracture, because the clinical pathway suggests that if you are at increased risk of fracture, it's much better to fix it before there's actually a break, do it preventatively or prophylactically. Now, another consequence of bone metastases can be a high calcium. And this has a number of symptoms associated with it. People can have nausea, they can vomit, they can get sleepy, and the main symptom, though, is really urinating a lot and being very thirsty, because as the calcium mobilizes, comes out of the bone, it forces passage through the kidney, urinary volume increases, you got to keep up with that with drinking, but at a time when you already may be nauseous. So high calcium, hypercalcemia, is a real issue. Another issue is particularly in the back, if the pain is severe or rapidly changing, there's concern that the bone metastases could be pressing on the spinal cord. And this is a medical emergency. The main symptoms, besides for aggravation of pain, and this can occur over hours, occasionally days, in the back, particularly the mid back, this requires really urgent evaluation, the use of steroids to reduce the swelling, radiation, and or surgery. But the key point is, if you have rapidly developing symptoms of back pain associated with weakness and neurologic changes, this is an urgent issue. So these are sort of, in the brief time I have, an overview of some of the consequences of bone metastases. Now, the other thing I want to now begin to introduce is the use of medications that can minimize the damage, minimize the chemical effect of bone metastases. So the main drug we use is a drug called bisphosphonates. There's a variety of different bisphosphonates, but we know that in certain cancers that can reduce the risk of a so-called skeletal-related event, which could be any of those things I just talked about, and can also improve pain. And so these are clearly recommended, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in the context of this education workshop. Now, what I'd like to do is focus in on breast cancer. So we've got two problems in breast cancer. One is actually, if unfortunately the breast cancer spreads to the bones, that's the bone metastases. And I've already talked about that. But what's of concern is osteoporosis in the woman who's receiving particularly hormone treatment for breast cancer. So in the postmenopausal women, the most commonly used hormone for treatment of breast cancer are aromatase inhibitors. And in the postmenopausal women, these are better than tamoxifen. Tamoxifen is an anti-estrogen, but it's not very logical, but it helps bone health. But the so-called aromatase inhibitors actually have a negative effect on bone health, increases the risk of weakening of the bone, osteoporosis. So there are a number of studies now that are ongoing, not quite to the point of a standard of care, but there's increasing evidence for the postmenopausal woman who's getting hormone therapy as part of the treatment to prevent recurrence, that various bisphosphonates may be of help in reducing the incidence of bone metastases. And actually, there's some evidence that it could also decrease the risk of recurrence in other sites besides the bone. A very interesting, and perhaps we'll get a chance to talk about it later. Now, in the premenopausal women, it's a different story. And here, the problem is really the chemical induction of early menopause. So we all know that a menopause in a normal woman is associated with weakening of the bones, part of the aging process. But this is accelerated in the woman who's receiving chemotherapy, premenopausal woman who's receiving chemotherapy, that can be put into menopause as a consequence of the chemotherapy. This may not be permanent, depends on a variety of factors, which we don't have time to go into, but the point is that if there's a chemotherapy-induced menopause, that this can accelerate bone loss, osteoporosis. And again, there's increasing data to show that the use of bisphosphonates can reduce the rate of osteoporosis, can reduce the incidence of bone metastases in these patients, and are a benefit. Let me then talk about prostate cancer. So one of the treatments of prostate cancer is to use androgen deprivation therapy. And this actually also results in loss of bone mass in men, the acceleration of osteoporosis in men, and there's increasing evidence to show, again, that the bisphosphonates may not only delay that process, but there's also some very interesting evidence that, in fact, not only does it delay bone loss, but also can reduce the recurrence rate for men who've been receiving androgen deprivation therapy. There are lots of interesting new treatments out there. There is a drug called dasatinib, which is in late clinical trial, not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration, but there are several studies that show that its mechanism of action is different, but it seems to be a very effective way of improving bone health and reducing the risk of skeletal-related events associated with a cancer. So let me just close by emphasizing the importance of communicating with your health team, the importance of a concept that we use, and that's the notion of shared informed decision-making. You need to be informed about various aspects. Obviously, you're not healthcare professionals, I assume, but you are because you're on this teleconference, you want to learn. We hope that patients would have a knowledge base so that, in fact, they could share with us decisions that are not clear-cut, because all of these treatments, although have benefit, also have side effects, and it's part of the judgment and clinical decision-making of what the potential benefits are versus the side effects are a discussion, and that falls under the notion of informed shared medical decision-making. So I look forward to the question and answer period. I've tried to talk about bone metastases in the broad sense, the various treatments that are available, including the use of bisphosphonates, and also then to emphasize this is an important issue, particularly for people who are receiving hormone therapy for breast cancer and prostate cancer. So I look forward to the question and answer, and thank you very much, Carolyn, for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Blum, for an outstanding presentation. Really very informative, excellent, lots of information, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Mike Brennan, and Dr. Brennan is a dentist. He's associate chairman, director, Sjögren's Syndrome and Salivary Disorders Center, Department of Oral Medicine, Carolina's Medical Center. And Dr. Brennan is going to review dental care before and during cancer treatments, which is so critically important, and dentist-doctor-patient communication. Dr. Brennan?
Hi, Carolyn. Yes, thank you for the opportunity to speak about this topic. What I'm really going to focus on, as Carolyn had noted, is really looking at the dental care issues that we look at as far as before cancer treatments start and also during cancer treatments, as well as look into a little bit on some things that we need to consider after dental or after cancer treatments are completed. Additionally, the communication has been brought up many times already in this afternoon's call, and that's very important, and I'll go a little bit into that as far as why that's so important, especially when we get to a multidisciplinary team approach as this. So let's first talk about, though, the dental evaluation before cancer treatment. Now, oral evaluation is very important prior to any cancer treatment, but really I'm going to keep coming back to this. The key is ongoing regular dental care, and not just one-time evaluation. The importance is to continue on even after care to receive routine dental care. The goal of dental treatment, though, before cancer therapy is really to eliminate or stabilize oral disease that puts someone at risk for problems that might develop during and following cancer treatments. So what that means is making sure that acute infections, active infections of the oral cavity are removed. So this might be a dental infection. That might be smoothing teeth that are causing sores in the mouth. You might have some sharp teeth. Taking care of any types of oral pain that someone has, that might be to tooth sensitivity, that might be from dental cavities, or it might be from a cracked tooth, or a lot of different reasons why you can have pain in the mouth. But it's important to eliminate this pain before someone does go through cancer treatment, just so that's not another issue that might come up during that care. Also, we want to make sure that there's no infections of the mucosa. You can have fungal infections, viral infections, and we want to make sure that there's no infections like that going into treatment. Also, one thing we want to look at is really identifying potential sources of future dental problems, and I'll go a little bit more into that coming up here. So ideally, we want dental disease eliminated prior to cancer treatment, but not all circumstances will allow that. There's a lot of different treatment modifiers that don't always allow everyone to be seen by their dentist prior to cancer treatment. That could be just the timing of dental care with cancer treatment. A lot of times with a new diagnosis of cancer, there's not a lot of time for someone to go, well, let's make sure all your teeth are in perfect shape. That's not always realistic to do. So it also depends on how ill someone is going into treatment. As far as some cancers, your immune system might be a little bit down a little bit more than others, and that might make might prevent certain types of dental care to be completed. And it does depend on the cancer diagnosis too, as well as the planned cancer treatment. So really the level of examination and diligence of precancer treatment oral assessment, it may vary depending on what the cancer diagnosis and what the planned cancer therapy is. So it really comes down to what types of cancer treatments might be associated with long-term risks. And what I mean by that is problems that might come later on after cancer treatment is provided. There's two in particular that come to mind. Someone who has head and neck cancer that is going to receive head and neck radiotherapy. With head and neck radiotherapy, that will impact the bones, the jaws, such that the blood flow isn't as great to the jaws after this type of radiation, which is necessary for treatment, is provided. And so someone that has received that type of therapy might be at increased risk for developing what's called osteoradionecrosis. And so that's one of the things that can happen with radiation therapy that happens to the head and neck region. And so in that particular case, it's very important to make sure to eliminate any types of a potential dental disease that might give a problem down in the future. The other issue is, we've already mentioned this, is the issue of IV bisphosphonates. So Zometa, Aridia are the two main types of treatments that have been found to be associated with bisphosphonate-associated osteonecrosis of the jaws. And so because of this, it's important before bisphosphonates are started on patients to make sure that teeth that might be a problem in the future, that might have acute infections, abscess, are removed before these therapies are started. So in these two situations, it's very important for a thorough clinical and radiographic evaluation to see if there's any dental treatment that needs to be completed. And really the elimination in these is to eliminate current dental disease in areas determined to be at risk for future dental infections. Now, other types of cancer treatments might have more short-term risks as far as just a standard dose chemotherapy with no IV bisphosphonates, less thorough clinical dental examination and different as far as radiographs to evaluate teeth. There really isn't as much need to be as thorough with that. It's really making sure someone doesn't in pain and there's no acute infections that are happening. Because in these kind of situations, these teeth, the problems with these type of teeth can be handled after cancer therapy is completed. Now, as far as during cancer treatment, so that was all before cancer treatment. Now, during cancer treatment, it's important to closely follow patients during their cancer treatment to help ensure that they avoid any types of problems that can impact their tolerance to cancer treatment. And for instance, if someone has pain that happens during cancer treatment or rarely people get dental infections during cancer treatment. It's really staying on top of that if something like that does happen. Now, it's important to review as far as with patients during cancer treatment, to review as far as making sure that appropriate oral care is provided, make sure the teeth, gums, and all the cheeks and mucosa, tongue are clean. And so that includes basic oral care with brushing, flossing, bland rinses. Those are usually typically what's done during cancer treatment. And really, during cancer treatment, the goal is preventive oral care to reduce potential oral infections and also to reduce some oral complications that can happen from cancer therapy. Keeping a cleaner mouth has been found to be helpful as far as mucositis, which is one of the mouth sores that can happen during chemotherapy and some radiation therapy. And so occasionally the management of acute dental problems such as infection may be required, but that's that rarely, usually that's treated with antibiotics and usually just so it's noticed early on and we can manage that as it comes along. Now, as far as care after cancer treatment, it's just important as far as just maintaining optimal dental care and seeing your dentist every 3 to 6 months, depending on the amount of dental disease that you have or amount of periodontal disease. And so it's just staying ahead of problems before they develop, and I think that's the key, is to prevent any long-term problems that might develop in the future. Now, as far as this really, the next point that I want to look into as far as the patient-dentist and oncologist communication, because I think this is very important that all the members of this multidisciplinary team, they have a role to play in assessment of oral problems. Patients, it's as far as important to communicate any areas of oral irritation or pain to the dentist and oncologist. It's important for the dentist to communicate with the oncologist any potential oral areas of concern that they may have, and of course, then the dentist and oncologist to communicate with each other as far as if dental treatment needs to be done, how that timing might take place if there's ongoing cancer treatment. As well as it's very important then for the dentist and the oncologist to communicate with the patient as far as a lot of things that we've already heard today as far as issues with things with cancer treatment, rationale for oral evaluation, importance of optimum oral health, and importance of expressing concerns with the teeth, anxieties of dental care, and really ensuring that appropriate preventive care happens during cancer treatment is maintained throughout. And I think I'll end there, and I look forward to the Q&A session.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Brennan. Just a really very helpful presentation, very informative for everyone on the call in terms of just helping people to understand how important it is in terms of care of one's teeth and mouth and gum and jaw. That's also important in terms of their well-being. And also the concept of that communication is so important with the whole healthcare team, and the dentist, the oncologist, the person living with cancer, very important. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And we now do have time for Q&A, and this is the time for Q&A. And I'm going to ask Mary to bring our speakers on board, Dr. Blum and Dr. Brennan. And standing in for Dr. Lane is Janet Curtin. She's a nurse practitioner, Metabolic Bone Service, Hospital for Special Surgery. So we now have all of our speakers on board and ready to take your questions. And I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, please remember that there are many of you on the call. If we don't get to your question, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and that number is in all of your materials at the end of the call. And we will definitely want to try to answer your questions. So please, we'll take as many as possible. If we don't get to your question, please call us. Okay, Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Eleanor A.
Hello. This can be answered by anyone who would be knowledgeable. I have primary liver cancer. I had a surgery in 2002. It reoccurred two times. And I now have the borderline between osteopenia and osteoporosis. I'm 61, and when you look at the medications that are available, they seem to have all side effects that would influence either the liver or my gallbladder or my intestines that I have other problems with. Is there anything that you could recommend, a particular medication or even perhaps a holistic alternative that would help me to build up my bone strength?
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Blum to address that question in a general way. There may be other people on the call who have similar concerns. Dr. Blum?
Sure. So the many parts of the question, I think, what would make sense to me really is to broaden it out. Although I emphasized, if you will, breast and prostate cancer, unfortunately, many types of cancers can go to the bone. So one issue is bone metastases. The other is bone health. Now, for any cancer, including the treatment, say, of liver cancer with certain so-called targeted drugs or chemotherapy, they can weaken the bones. It is an issue, but has to be balanced with many other things, and I think this is a time when to ask the question of your healthcare provider, I'm concerned about my bone health, I'm concerned about what alternatives there might be, not only conventional, but very importantly to bring up with your healthcare provider so-called complementary or perhaps even alternative approaches to keep this open communication to assess what's known about it, what the potential benefits of a treatment are, and many of these complementary and alternative treatments do have significant risks that could influence cancer treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lori S.
Hi. My question is for the first doctor, Dr. Lanes, or the person who's filling in for him. He had mentioned that about vitamin D, that 1,000 to 2,000 international units is kind of thought to be what a person should be taking, but that in a cancer setting, we need to make sure vitamin D is not elevating your calcium level. I didn't understand that, and I was hoping she could explain that a little further.
That's a great question. Thank you. That's a wonderful question. Janet, can you address that question, please?
Yes. Yes, I can. We do look at the vitamin D and calcium levels very closely, and that's why we have to work with the oncologist, because in some cases, vitamin D can cause a calcium increase. We do recommend 1 to 2,000 units of vitamin D. In addition to what's in your multivitamin and your calcium tablets, and many calcium tablets have vitamin D already in them. So what we have to do is work with the oncologist, keeping the calcium levels always in front of our minds about this when we prescribe it. So this is why we have a team effort here to help you. We maintain the basic metabolic health of the bone, and we work very closely with your oncologist to make sure that we do not have an increase in the calcium.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Carol C.
I'd like to have anybody that's available there to take my question. Can
sure.
you hear me okay?
Oh, of course, we hear you beautifully.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I have just recently run across on the internet that green tea extract works against Velcade in the treatment of myeloma. And I just wondered if any of you know anything about that. Also, the other supplements are alpha-lipoic acid and resveratrol, that they're counterproductive and not to be used. Do you know anything about those?
Okay, well, Carol, thank you for those questions. I'm going to ask Dr. Blum to address these questions, and also, Dr. Blum, if you would also address the issue of the Internet, information from the Internet, and so I'm going to turn this over to you, Dr. Blum.
Sure. Getting information is really a challenge. There's so much of it out there, and the first thing, of course, is to make sure that the source of information you have is scientifically based and reputable. And that's sometimes hard to tell. And so I would encourage you, as an example, Cancer Care has a wonderful website. It's on all your materials in terms of complementary and alternative approaches. There are many other websites. I'm sure there are links on Cancer Care's website. There's an excellent website called
NCI, the National Cancer Institute website, www.cancer.gov.
Right, and another would be cancer.net, but they would lead you to valid, objective discussions of what potential risks and benefits are. But the way I answer the question when my patients ask me, and I really try to elicit, are you using any complementary alternative medicine? Sometimes we don't ask, and sometimes patients don't tell us, but the key is to understand that some medications have a low potential of benefit and usually don't have many side effects, and it's probably those are fine. On the other hand, there are some medications, alternative and complementary, they're really quite active and pharmacologically active and may have significant benefit but also have significant risk, particularly because they interact with other kinds of medications, prescription medications. So I would be very cautious. I would certainly bring it up with your healthcare provider. Make no assumptions as to efficacy or safety.
Excellent. And do you want to comment about green tea? Just in general, comment about that. I know people often ask about that.
Sure. So my notion is green tea tastes good. Likely, probably doesn't help very much. Likely, doesn't hurt very much in reasonable quantities. Any of these things, though, can obviously in high quantities can have both more potent, both on the positive and the negative effect. So the bottom line, from my perspective, it deserves discussion.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Karen S.
Yes, hello. Thank you for a wonderful presentation. This question is directed to Dr. Blum. Dr. Blum, you spoke about use of some bisphosphonates potentially in reducing the risk of recurrence. And I'm wondering if you might be able to speak to any clinical trials or information that's out there specifically related to IV Zometa. Specifically, I'm 52, osteopenia, postmenopausal, but I know that there's been some discussion of using IV Zometa as an off-label drug to reduce the risk of recurrence, and I'm wondering if you might be able to get into any of those types of information in a little bit more detail.
Okay, thank you very much, Karen. And Dr. Blum, would you be able to address that in a general way?
Yeah, it's evolving data, and this is something we deal with on a regular basis. The data is looking really quite promising that, in fact, the bisphosphonates may reduce the risk of recurrence, not only in bone but elsewhere. And I would encourage you, one, to talk to your physician. Two is that there are a number of websites, including the Cancer Care website, and the American Society of Clinical Oncology is about to have a big meeting. They usually get about 30,000 people. If cancer.net, www.cancer.net, is a website that will carry all this latest scientific information. The meeting is going to be in the first week in June, and this would be a great source. That's where I'm going to find out about it, and that's where your physicians are going to find out about it. And there is this website of the American Society of Clinical Oncology that will put it in the doctor's voice to the patient. And I would encourage you to go there and talk to your physician.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Susan B.
Yes. I had a question for Dr. Blum.
Yes.
I currently had, from due to the chemo, I have breast cancer and was induced menopause due to the chemo. And because I may have had a possible TIA, they did not want me to take the tamoxifen. So I am on Arimidex, and also I get a monthly shot of Lupron. My question was, you had mentioned there is a drug, and I didn't get the complete name of it. It's in a clinical trial. That you said it's not approved, but would help with bone loss?
Yeah, so you bring up a good question. Just to reinforce, the point is that there are new treatments. The drug called dasatinib is being developed. The clinical trials are late, and that is that the data looks very promising. We all expect the drug to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration as a regulatory agent here in the U.S., and I know it's before other regulatory agents. And the point of this drug, it has a different mechanism of action. As Dr. Lane alluded to, it's a RANK ligand inhibitor, from my perspective, it gives us an alternative for various kinds of ways to improve bone health, and it just expands the opportunity. But at the moment, it's not commercially available, but as an oncologist, I'm certainly excited about the data and look forward to add it to my options for patients like you.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you for that question, Susan. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Helen B.
Excellent information. I appreciate it. But can you please go over again the difference between the aromatase inhibitors and versus the tamoxifen? I wasn't real clear on that, the pros and cons.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Blum?
So we know that hormonal treatment can be effective for breast cancer, which is the context of your question. Tamoxifen, as Dr. Lane alluded to, is an anti-estrogen, but it also is a SERM, so a specific estrogen receptor modifier. So it has positive effects on the bone. And in premenopausal women, that's the treatment of choice, generally. For postmenopausal women, it turns out that the group of agents called aromatase inhibitors are somewhat more effective in terms of preventing recurrence of breast cancer and treating metastatic breast cancer in the advanced postmenopausal woman. But the problem is that aromatase inhibitors don't have bone preservation properties. So that comes in the issue of you have to use another agent like a bisphosphonate, like this RANK ligand compound that's coming out, dasatinib. So it, as always, there's a gain and a loss, and these have to be balanced out. So I hope that answers your question.
Excellent. I want to thank our speakers. All of you have been just absolutely terrific. Thank you so much. Just outstanding. And I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions, because your questions really enhance the call. We really appreciate you doing that. And all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind all of you this is a one-hour education program, and that we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. With that in mind, I want to remind you about all the resources that you can access from Cancer Care. We have 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to help with practical and financial assistance, counseling, support groups, publications, telephone workshops like this one, our podcasts of the program, replays of these programs. So there's lots of different information you can get from Cancer Care. Most importantly, I don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you're alone. I want you to now feel you're part of a community of support and that we're here to help you. Please do call us, 1-800-813-HOPE. All that information's in your materials. We are truly here to help you. And again, we don't want you to feel that you're alone in trying to wrestle with all your problems. Do call us. Our staff are really eager to help you. Thank you so much for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.